welcome back to the Lumieres podcast. My name is Jodie White and thank you for joining me once more. My guest today is the fabulous writer and occasional BBC radio presenter, Mr. Ian Marchant. So if you've heard one of the last two episodes with Bob Robrey, you'll know that Bob is the kind of muse slash subject of Ian Marchant's new book, which is called A Hero for High Times, and which is out now, by the way. And I'd heard Ian's name mentioned a couple of times since moving up here, and Bob told me and showed me the book. So it felt like a perfect synchronicity to just follow on with the thread that weaves through all these podcasts and go and chat with Mr. Ian Marchant himself. Happily, he lives only 5 minutes walk from my house. So a couple of weeks back, I wandered down and set up the mic in Ian's kitchen, and we had a fantastic chat about Ian's life, how he ended up getting to Prestine, how he got started as a writer. And we talked quite a lot about the subject of his new book, which is A Hero for High Times, out now, Jonathan Cape, and the hidden history of British counterculture, which hasn't really been documented by that many people. And I think this is going to be quite an important book that Ian's written, and I can't wait to read it myself. Ian's a very funny man, and we had a great time chatting. I'm very grateful to him for his time, and I hope you will, after listening to this chat, maybe go out and feel inspired to buy a copy of Ian's new book. So once again, thank you for downloading, listening, sharing, liking, subscribing, and even reviewing this podcast. Yes, you can do that. You can do that on iTunes. You can do that on Facebook. Go and like the page. Give me a review. 5 stars, please. And then you can follow me on social media. Facebook is facebook.com/Lumieres Podcast. Instagram.com. You can find the Lumieres Podcast if you want to follow me on there. Thank you, as always, to Six Organs of Admittance for the opening and closing music. The song is called Light of the Light and is on Ben Chesney's album Asleep on the Floodplain on Drag City Records. Thank you to both of them, as usual. And without further ado, I introduce to you the wonderful world of Mr. Ian Marchant. Hi, Ian. Thanks
Hello,
for
Jodie.
Joining me.
Huge pleasure.
It's wonderful to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me to your lovely little abode. So we were just talking before we turned the mic on about Prestine and about how we arrived here. And I'm just curious about your journey before you arrived in Prestine. It's something that everyone that I meet, I've been like, oh, so how did you kind of arrive here? Because it's interesting to me how people arrive in somewhere that sort of seems to harbour quite a few characters. I don't know if that's a border thing, but there's something about the borders where there's some real interesting people along this kind of area. So, how did you end up in Prestine?
Well, I mean, you know, the border thing is very interesting. And from our front door to the English border is 10 seconds, about that.
Just going to walk to England.
Yeah, just going to walk to England. It's about 10 seconds away. And there's something about the border which, you know, traditionally you have to be flexible. Mm. You know, people are going to come and go, aren't they? And you're going to have to accommodate invaders. And this house, which is about 500 years old.
Wow.
One of the oldest houses in Prestine.
Wow.
Contains timbers from older houses that were burnt by Owen Glendower. When he swept through Prestine.
Forgive my history, but when are we talking? When's that?
Glendower was about 1450s, 1460s that he came through.
Wow.
So there are timbers in here. In
older
this
than
house.
America.
Older than America. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I love that about where we live in this island, like just the depth of history. Sometimes you try and stop and think about it. It's so overwhelming to just even contemplate how many lives have passed through these buildings, and, you know,
it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah.
And if you think about the border, I mean, there's a Civil War skirmish in Prestine.
Yeah.
A reasonably big Civil War skirmish.
Yeah.
That was fought up and down Broad Street
Up and down Broad Street?
Up and down Broad Street, yeah.
Wow.
So the site of where the assembly rooms are now, there were shots fired. There were shots fired on the Lug Bridge.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Just thinking that there was a war outside.
There was a war outside this window, and the castles in Prestine. One of which is the warden. There's nothing there to see now except a mount.
Yeah,
that was a Morton Bailey, and they faced their enemies, the Mortimers, at Stapleton, which just over the hill.
Yeah.
This border was absolutely a real border, a live border, and it shifted.
Yeah.
So lots of Welsh places have made up English names.
Okay.
Or the other way round, they have Welsh names and made up English ones.
Right.
But Prestine was called Prestine, but then the Welsh took it over and it became Llanandrus. And so... then the English took it back and it became Prestine again. So its Welsh name, Llanandrus, was in fact its name at one time.
Ah.
And, you know, it would have been a Welsh-speaking place. There were Welsh-speaking canons in Hereford Cathedral up until the 1820s.
Wow.
In order to accommodate Welsh-speaking.
Wow.
Sorry to... I haven't answered any of your questions. I'm a historian, you see.
No, it's fascinating. It's great. This is the sort of stuff that I want to learn
about. So I crack into it. On one level, I move with my family to Prestine because of divorce, death, and I couldn't stand living in Brighton anymore. You know, it became too much. On the other hand, of course, we were part of a broad social movement starting in the late 60s.
Right.
Of people, of hippies, really, of countercultural people
moving
to the countryside.
Yeah.
For various reasons. It became housing was cheap, for one thing. Which it still is to some extent compared to the city.
Very much so, yeah.
So that was one reason that people came. They came as well because it was lightly policed, which to some extent it still is, I'm sorry to say. But that's true, you know, it was lightly policed. It wasn't...
But there's something nice about that, you know, like when you go to some towns and there's, like, police cars driving around all the time and... I know that the idea is to make you feel safe in your homes, but sometimes it has the opposite effect. Like, you just feel like you're being monitored. And I think something I noticed very much in this place is just feels like everyone just is getting on with things and sort of monitoring themselves. And it's not the sort of place that you need police, really, do you? I mean, I'm sure they could kind of count the amount of cases they have, you know, on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
I can't imagine they're that busy with kidnappings and burglaries and things.
Sasha in the chip shop said to me once, the traffic warden was up and down the high street, and she said, "We don't need traffic wardens, this is Prestine." And I know what she meant. We don't. Every time that forces of law and order come and fiddle about in any shape or form, it doesn't help. Glad they're there. You need them in an emergency.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. So this kind of it lends this sort of feel to not like a lawlessness, but just a sense of space or something. You know, I mean, compounded by the landscape, but
yeah.
For somebody who is creative and is wanting to create new projects and new works, it's something about the space around you as well, like I imagine for people coming up.
Yeah.
Is that similar for you? Do you feel more able to create when you're in a more, like a piece, more peaceful environment? Some people thrive off the city, you know. Like.
Yeah, no, I don't really.
Yeah.
I lived in that London for a bit. After I was here, I went to Lancaster and then I went to London for a few years and then I went back down to Devon and then I came back.
Okay.
Having been driven away by... It's difficult to make a living.
Yeah.
And once I worked out how to make a living, I came back. But there were, you know, 20-odd years in there...
Right.
...you know, that took me to sort how am I going to make a living out.
Yeah.
And I tended to live in rural places, in rural Lancashire.
Yeah.
Very rural Devon. More rural than this. When I came back, people said to me, oh, is it good to be back in the countryside? Honestly, no idea.
Whereabouts in Devon was that?
I lived in a place called Sheepwash.
You're joking.
No.
My parents live in the next village.
No, where?
Black Torrington.
Do they?
Yeah.
That's superb.
As a nice little...
It is. Well, I don't wish...
It is very rural there.
It is.
Right.
I don't wish to oversell my work. Mm. But my marvellous book, The Longest Crawl, starts essentially with me walking to Black Torrington by night.
Really?
To have a drink with Bob from over the road, yeah.
In the Torridge Inn?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I bet it was, yeah, well, won't say anything about what it's like now.
Well...
Not so great.
It sort of comes and goes. There was a time, a few years ago, it was really good.
Yeah.
There was a gourmet chef there.
Yeah.
The Jack Russell Terrier comes from Black Torrington.
The Jack Russell Terrier?
Right, man. The Jack Russell Terrier was first bred in Black Torrington.
That's a good nugget. I like that.
Yeah.
Was first bred in Black Torrington?
Yeah, most certainly.
I wonder if they know that. I bet they don't know that.
There you go.
I'll pass that one on.
So, well, I worked for Arvon, if you know what the Arvon Foundation is.
The writing place. Yeah. I've know of them, yeah.
So that's how I was in that. And I very often find myself in this situation, being interviewed by people from that area, because... Again, I don't wish to oversell my work.
Please.
Yeah, but my book about railways, which is brilliant, and which has reinvented contemporary train spotting. No, it has. No, it really has. Honestly, it has. This is my biggest claim to fame.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
Thank you.
Cultural change agent.
I think so. I got interviewed on Radio 2. And it's the Drive Time show on Radio 2. And I was really looking forward to it because at that time it was done by Johnny Walker.
Yeah, classic.
Who's a hero of mine from way back when. Except, selfishly, he'd just been diagnosed as having cancer.
Oh.
And he had to take a break from doing the show.
Yeah.
And they got stand-ins to do it. And the stand-in that they got to interview me was Noel Edmonds, right?
Noel Edmonds was the stand-in.
It was a stand-in, yeah.
Which era are we talking here?
We're talking about 2002, 2003. He only did a fortnight.
Okay.
But, you know, they got some of the greats of radio broadcasting to come and do it. It was his first day. And Noel Edmonds lives in Hatherley, right?
No way.
Way.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I said to him, so... He said, oh, this is my first day back on the radio for 25 years. I'm thinking, your first day back on the radio for 25 years, you get to talk to a bloke from Hatherley about train spotting.
And how did
Could
it...
have just gone to the pub, really. He was all right.
Yeah, did it go well?
He's all right. He's tiny.
Is he?
Noel Edmonds. He's like that. He's about 2 inches high. Honestly, he's got huge buffed up hair.
Yeah, I imagine.
And big elevator heels. He's like 5 foot or something, honestly.
Was he quite well tanned?
I liked him. He had read the book, and very often, you know, you'll talk to people and they'll have just looked at the press release.
Yeah.
But I think perhaps because he was coming back to the radio and was anxious, he'd read the whole thing.
Wow, amazing.
So he too was swept up in the new wave of Trainspotting. which I'd initiated.
The new wave of British Trainspotting?
Yeah. That's me.
Yeah, can't really acronym.
Not yet.
No. Maybe we'll develop one.
So the countryside was important, but you know, I went to university at Lampeter.
Oh yeah.
By a bizarre twist of fate, I'm still at university at Lampeter, 40 years later. And Lampeter in the mid-70s was the Wild West, man. It was the Wild West.
Yeah.
It really was.
Yeah.
It really was. The streets were paved with cannabis resin. They really were. And acid was... It was like water, you know. It was like, do you want some acid? You know, yeah. And it's quite odd that we tried acid, really, given fact that the hills were covered in a superabundance of psilocybin mushrooms. Yeah.
Why would you need to...
Nonetheless, we did. But yeah. But what we didn't know, why was acid so cheap and freely available in Lambton? Huh. Because of Operation Julie, which was about to go off, which was the world's biggest drugs bust at that time.
Ah.
And the world's biggest LSD factory had its... as it were, wholesale outlet in the hills beyond Lambton.
No way.
Way.
This is... oh, I just feel like a student of life.
Well, that's why you'll enjoy my new book. Cause
do you know what? I'm really looking forward to reading that, Ian. To be 100% clear, I'd not heard of you or your works before I moved here.
I'm a mid-lister.
A mid-lister?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
A mid-list. I mean, I would say that I'm the mid-lister's mid-lister, but mid-listers haven't even heard of one another. A mid-lister is someone who's had a living at writing one way or another without anyone ever having heard of them. and there are loads of us.
But you're making a living out of it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not... I mean...
We live modestly.
But it's a funny classification, isn't it, of, like, what is success with writing? Is success that you manage, that you can publish? Or does it mean how many X copies you sell? I guess different people would have different connotations of what it means, whether, I guess, might be correlated on how much they depend on it for their income. It seems like, so how long have you been permanently focused on your writing now?
Since the early 90s, really. Kind of since I left here. I arrived here in the late 80s, met my friend Bob Robry, who I think you've spoken to, stayed here for about 3 years. And then went to Lancaster University, because I went to Lampeter University. As I say, drugs, sex, rock and roll. We were the first punk band in Mid Wales.
We were. What were you called?
We were called the Repeaters.
Nice, strong. That was pretty strong.
And then we moved down back to Brighton to go and be sort of nothing in the Brighton scene, really.
That's so funny, because I have the exact same story with the band that I was in Leicester University, and we were doing really well, and then we thought, oh, Leicester's a bit dead, let's move to Brighton and make it. And we were doing pretty well as well, but we were just playing the toilet venues and everything, and it was fun, and then our singer left, and that was the end of that. But it was fun for a while. It's great playing in bands, isn't it?
Yeah.
Really good fun.
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
I do miss it, actually.
I do, and because I've lost my voice as well.
Oh, because you were singing?
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
And the toilet venues in Brighton are different toilet venues from my day. You know, and the scene was different when I was in Brighton, so people were just about to break out of it and never did quite. So you had the Piranhas, who had a couple of hits and then petered out.
Or okay.
My brother's band, which was Peter and the Test Tube Babies, who even had a top 40 hit.
That name rings a bell, yeah.
It's still sort of hacking along on the Brighton, on the punk scene in particular.
Was it pretty punk-centric when you were there then?
New wave-centric. New wavy. Because it was 1979 when we went back.
Yeah.
So that didn't happen, and I ended up back in the countryside, and I had a market stall when I was here.
What were you selling?
I was selling records.
Oh, nice.
And I was selling smokers' requisites.
Oh, yes. Paraphernalia,
yeah. It was a head stall.
Head stall?
It was.
Was it Prestine's first head stall?
I didn't come to Prestine. I did Hay, I did Kington, I did Crossgates, I did Churchstoke.
Yeah. Wow, you did quite a few then.
I know.
Wow, so there's currently, since you closed the stall down, no one took up the mantle.
No, I don't think anyone has ever used paraphernalia since... Well, there's a bloke on Hereford Market now, isn't there?
I haven't been to Hereford Market.
Yeah, there is. Or the one that's up the middle of the street.
Okay.
So I went to... I failed at Lambeter. I should have pointed this out.
And what were you studying? at Lampeter?
Who can possibly say? Well, I think it was philosophy.
Was that on the deed?
That's what it said on the paper, yeah. Mm. I failed. It's very hard to fail a degree. I didn't drop out.
Yeah, especially a degree that's kind of quite... How do you assess a philosophy degree? Like, surely you just have to impress the tutors or something. I don't know.
Hang on. How long have we gone? Good evening and welcome to Objective Standards of Judging Philosophy. Well, you know, there's a way.
Okay.
And I didn't begin to... No. No. And so 10 years later, I went to Lancaster. And at Lancaster, I did the history of science.
Right.
With a one-unit minor in creative writing.
Okay.
And this is a very good degree if you want to be a writer, because obviously no one is ever going to give you a job, aren't they? You know, what possible conceivable job? We wanted historians of science.
Yeah, you see that all the time.
But I came out determined to write, and like lots of beginning writers, I did stuff. I had a few short stories published. I got a little break where I managed to do some work with the BBC.
Yeah.
Quite early on. I managed to get agented. And I would teach in primary schools bits and bats of creative writing workshop schools.
Yeah.
Plus, I worked in a second-hand bookshop.
Yeah.
So I had all that sort of career trajectory of a young writer.
Yeah.
And the beauty of being a young writer is that I was in my mid-30s.
Yeah.
You know, to a young writer, you don't start till you're in your mid-30s.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
So I did all of that stuff, but by the end of the 90s, I was living in a caravan on a load of allotments in Lancaster and writing what became my second novel, because I was penniless. I mean, I was sort of pretty much begging. I mean, close to it. There were days where I had no money, no food. And then I'd phone my agent. And we'd been rejected by pretty much every publisher in London. But again, that's the game for a young writer, you know.
Rejections.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Part of it.
And one day, suddenly, Victor Galanx signed my first novel.
Mm. Amazing.
For the sum of £2,000. £2,000 to me was like, you're kidding. £2,000. £2,000.
But then, I mean, that must be such an amazing feeling, having given the nature of the way it's come to you as well, and in the conditions of, you know, well, I really need a break.
Really, I really needed a break, Jodie. I really, really needed a break, and I got a break. And although my material circumstances have improved slightly, because I've done things like work for the Arvon Foundation.
Yeah.
Helping people write, and I still tutor for Arvon, and I taught creative writing at a university, and I ran a second-hand bookshop.
Mm-hmm.
So I get sort of elevating through the... and the BBC stuff, the BBC has been good to me, really.
Mm. How did you get involved with the BBC then? That started, you mentioned earlier.
So I got a kind of little breakette thing.
Yeah, as a presenter?
No, initially as a kind of, I went on a little course that was run by the BBC and Arvon.
Yeah.
To do writing for the radio.
Ah.
But it was a selected course and 800 people had applied and only 16 of us got on. We were a bit chuffed, really. We were all quite pleased with ourselves. I'm still quite pleased with myself.
And that led to further opportunities.
It just meant that... So the tutor was Simon Armitage and his wife, Sue Roberts. And it just meant I had a tiny little foot.
Yeah. That's how things generally happen, isn't it, in a lot of ways?
But I didn't do... I didn't really start presenting until about 2006. And I'd moved back here and I had an email from it. You see, it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it's all to do with the old school tie.
Oh.
Yes. But what I wasn't expecting was that it wouldn't be my school, because it would have been quite surprising if people from New Haven Tideway... I mean...
Oh, you're one of the New Haven boys.
Yeah.
Open the door.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You know, and in fact, it's you know, tended over the years to be the opposite. You from New Haven went to New Haven Tideway. You can't come in, my friend, because you'll set fire to the place and nick things.
Right, 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 right.
Now, I got my break in presenting through my daughter's school, and it was an old school friend of my daughter's called Holly Blackwell, who's working at a TV producer at Border TV in Carlisle, and said, I'm making a documentary about Thomas Telford for Border TV. Do you want to come and present it for me? Oh, I was thinking Esme's dad would be good at doing that.
That's great.
And because I'd written a book about trains and stuff, having reinvented contemporary British trains. And so I went and did this programme with Holly. And I have a radio face.
Right.
So what do you mean, right?
I'm just, you know.
Yeah.
If you say so.
Yeah. So I looked weird on the telly, I think.
Okay.
And Holly was off to become the Lovely Eggs and was just about sort of wasn't a producer for very long. But out of that and out of people reading my railway book, the Parallel Lines book, then radio presenters, producers starting contacted me.
Mm.
And so over the last 12 years or so, I've got to do some fantastic stuff with the BBC. I mean, extraordinary stuff.
Mm.
I went to America. We drove across America in search of barbed wire. The history of barbed wire. Did a fantastic thing about the North-South divide.
That's so great.
So the BBC has been kind. I've got a good agent. Who's always managed to get my ideas taken up, some of them more successfully than others.
Mm.
Because, I mean, that's the problem. From my point of view, this has been the thing that handicaps me as a writer, is that instead of turning out formulaic stuff, which I should do, which I clearly should do, that, you know, I should clearly make cheerful travel books.
Right.
These are the things that have been sort of most successful,
right.
But I couldn't quite do it. Instead of cleaving to a formula, I get obsessed with an idea and think, I've got to do that.
But that's where I don't know. When you have that passion for an idea, for a concept, and you follow it through, that you can't replace that with... It's very hard to push passion into something that you're not passionate about. And I think when you read something that's been created with passion, hopefully that comes through in a way that, you know, something more formulaic perhaps wouldn't have the same feeling in the writing.
But plenty of writers do it, and plenty of writers turn out formulaic non-fiction stuff.
Mm, yeah.
They do. And so there's a particular writer I've got in mind. Just going to cough. There's a particular writer I've got in mind who I won't name, although his name is Simon Winchester. And you might not have heard of Simon Winchester.
No.
But he turns out there's a book every 18 months, and it'll be about the Atlantic Ocean. Excuse me. The Pacific Ocean. Or it'll be about language. Or it'll be about painting. And these things come out every couple of years, and they'll sell 50,000 copies.
Wow.
You know, about that. As you know, the libraries will buy them. It's an easy thing to buy for your dad, you know, or my
that
dad likes
kind of stuff.
The sea.
Generic.
And they're all very well done. But they're all to a formula, really.
Strange. There's something strange about that.
Except that he lives in a really nice house in London.
Yeah, well, it depends what you're doing it for. If you just want to do it for that, or, well, if you have a motivation that is financial, then...
But I've nothing against... If the book about Bob, which, you know, I'm... See, the thing is, I'm always convinced... that the books are going to sell a million copies. I don't sit here thinking, oh, I'd like to be a cult mid-lister.
No,
who occasionally makes programmes for Radio 4. No, fuck
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to sell billions. I want to sell on the level that Dan Brown, you know, I want never to have to talk to somebody like you ever again at my kitchen table. You know, if I'm being interviewed, I want Piers Morgan. Do you know what I mean?
Do you?
No.
Glad we cleared that up. Shocking, Ian Marchant. Yeah.
But, no, I didn't sort of think, oh, you know, I'll be poor. But Ursula K. Le Guin,
yeah,
who's one of my heroes of writing, said writers get paid in freedom, in time, as much as we do in money. And
yeah, that's a whole other debate, isn't it? Like, what is wealth? Yeah.
So in that sense, we have been wealthy.
Mm.
Yeah, of course. Mm. But I'd like the books to sell, because what I want is a readership as a writer.
Yeah, you want people to be appreciating what you've been putting all your time
and
energy into.
And you want to change the world. I do. A Hero for High Times. Oh, it's funny. I seem to have a copy here.
Oof.
It's called A Hero for High Times, A Young Reader's Guide to the Beats, Hippies, Heads, Freaks, Punks, Ravers, New Age Travellers and Dog on a Rope Brew Crew Crusties of the British Isles, 1956 to 1994.
That is a subtitle.
Yeah. And... of course I'd like to sell it, and I'd like people to read it, and I'd like younger people in particular, I think, to read it.
Mm. I'm fascinated to read it because it fills in this gap that I have no real, you know, it's kind of before my time, but it's fascinating history that informs so much of, like, where we are now. So, yeah, I mean, I think we should be... let's talk about it a little bit more.
Okay.
So... where does the genesis for the book come from? Because we know that Bob features quite heavily, and it's kind of you've taken the themes of his life and the way that he's moved through life and then extrapolated that out into a wider context.
Yeah. It occurred to me that it would be... I'm going to just coughing.
No worries.
It occurred to me that it would be a good thing to do a book about the British Underground, not to reinvent British Underground spotting, but the counterculture, the underground, the hippies, the beats, the freaks. There was a book there.
Mm.
There are lots of books about the American counterculture,
right?
And so you can kind of trace. There were the American beats, and there's Leary and Ken Kesey.
Yeah.
And they took acid, and there are lots of books. So there's the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
And films now.
And films. Mm. And so then you have High Ashbury, and you have the Democratic Convention in Chicago, 1968. So the whole thing, sort of Altamont, the whole thing's Manson, the whole thing's ends in a nightmare.
Yeah.
The whole thing is an American story. No one's told this story from a British perspective.
Mm.
Of course, some of the impulses are American, but I wanted to tell a British story. And I keep thinking, I'll talk to Bob about that. Oh, Bob will know about that.
So how did you first meet Bob? Because he told me that he met you, he was driving a motorbike with a shotgun in one hand or something like that. Is that?
Yeah, that would do. Yeah, very similar. Yeah, he turned up outside our house one day on a motorbike with a gun in his pocket. Yeah.
What do you say to when that happens?
Come in, friends. we just hit it off.
Yeah. So this was when you were in Pristine the first time. You met Bob.
up in the Radnor Valley.
Oh, so you're outside on the
Kinnerton
inside
in the Radnor Valley. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
Which oddly. a house called The Rack, which we sold to a bloke called Nicholas Murray, mm-hmm. who runs The Rack Press there.
Oh, okay.
And he's a writer, he's a fellow writer.
Oh, fantastic.
It's a weird writerly house. Brilliant.
That's
so
nice.
So Bobby turned up. And so I keep thinking, oh, I'll talk to him about being a beat, because Bob lived on the streets of London as a beat, lived on the streets of London, mm-hmm. as it was the hippest thing to do. Bob went dancing to trad jazz. I mean, you know, or when the Saints got, you know, difficult to imagine now anything sort of naffer at the time.
Yeah.
You know, the cutting
the
edge.
The height of cool, yeah.
The height of cool, the absolute height of cool. Mm. And then he came out of that, and then he was involved in the Profumo affair. And the Profumo affair took down the Tory government, but it was also a huge boost in the arm for British comedy, really, for Private Eye and the satire boom. Mm. And then Bob was involved in... so he sold acid to R.D. Lang, and R.D. Lang was the kind of British Timothy Leary, mm. and Bob hung out with... he was just in the clubs, and he was... And then he did the hippie trail... And I kept, and then he moved to the countryside and was involved with Howard Marks and Mr. Nice and the IRA. And then he went to the States. And so he had all these fantastic stories about the British Underground. Mm. Oh, and then in the 80s, he was in a living vehicle and was on the periphery of the peace convoy and so on and so forth.
It seems like there isn't really any... There couldn't really be that many people who've had that breadth of experience.
No. No. He's very... He's like Zelig. He's like Forrest Gump.
Mm.
You know, if you had made up a novel about Bob, and if a student came to me and said, I've got this idea about a bloke who just happened accidentally to be everywhere...
It is like that, isn't it?
It is. I would say, no, I don't think that's...
It's not believable.
I don't think that's believable, no. But Bob just kind of was everywhere.
Mm.
And so he became the backbone of the book. So it's the life of Bob, but also his life and times. So Bob, as an example... Bob, in the early 70s, moved with his then-partner, Monica, to Hay.
Mm-hmm.
And they... I mean, they were selling clothes, but they also started selling whole food. Lentils and brown rice. Mm. Because that was what the hippies ate.
Mm-hmm.
So... Bob and Monica ran the first Whole Food shop around here. You know, for miles around, hippies would go and buy their rice and beans and so on. So it enabled me to tell the story of voluntary vegetarianism and macrobiotics in particular,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, is a fantastic... So Bob and Monica were buying big sacks of rice and beans from a bloke called Craig Sams.
Ah, that's funny.
Have you heard of Craig Sams? He lives next to your mum.
No. He lives in Hastings, but I know...
He does, doesn't he?
He's a friend of a friend, and I was going to have a chat with him, but ended up chatting to his brother Greg instead.
Did you?
Who, on a few podcasts back. Yeah, and he's a lovely guy, very interesting, and again was like, I wouldn't be surprised if he knows Bob. Because they were around that same scene.
That's right, yeah, sort of Notting Hilly scene, yeah.
But yeah.
So Bob was my way in to tell the story of the Sams brothers. And
that's fascinating.
And macrobiotics.
Yeah.
So everything gets a tiny little potted history, as it were.
Okay, right.
So hopefully, because people don't know these stories...
Mm.
I hope that people read the book and go, I would like to find out more about the history of macrobiotics or...
But you've tied it all together. You've tied all these different things together. Like you said, there wasn't really anything that's traversed these in one book.
Yeah, and because I think there was a coherent culture. I think it was a coherent thing the counterculture up until the mid-90s. And I think at the point of the mid-90s, it sort of fell apart. Because people these days, for example, thinking about music, you have the genreisation of music. That kind of didn't happen until, I think, the mid-90s. You know, when I say... I mean, you played in bands. What did you do?
I'm a drummer.
Were you?
Still am.
Yeah. So, Joe, do you know what I mean by rock and roll music?
Old-time rock and roll.
No, you see. Exactly. No.
When I think of rock and roll, I think of Chuck Berry.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, rock and roll.
But that's...
So it still made sense as a term right up until the mid-90s.
Okay.
You know, Liam Gallagher go, I'm a rock and roll star.
Yeah.
And people at that point didn't think, oh, he's turned into Little Richard or something. They understood what it meant to be a rock and roll star. There were such things.
In that context, like rock star, that still makes complete sense. You know, like Robert Plant's the rock star, that kind of thing. I think that sort of endures. But you're talking about the genreification, the splitting up of like, well, Oasis is indie. It's not rock. You know, don't we file them in the indie section of HMV or whatever it was?
Yeah, despite being on EMI or whatever.
Yeah. It's strange when you start getting into these terms. It has continued to get really crazy over the last kind of 10 years as well, like sub.
So there is no longer a lingua franca, which popular music was.
Mm.
The world's biggest entertainment brand were the Beatles.
Mm.
The Beatles... much of the counterculture in this country was funded by Paul McCartney.
Huh, interesting.
International Times was entirely funded by Macca.
Ah. Yeah. Is this in the book?
Yeah. His more conservative colleagues, like Lennon.
Yeah.
the only middle-class member of the Beatles, of course.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the mid-60s and before Lennon and began to unbutton and become interested in this stuff.
Yeah, I guess it's funny because I never really... Growing up, the Beatles were the Beatles, but I never... It wasn't really... They didn't really... My parents didn't really place that much importance on them in the spectrum. My dad's really into prog, and so we got Pink Floyd, all the Canterbury set, Jazz to Soft Machine, all that kind of stuff, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, King Crimson. So I was brought up with all that kind of stuff, and my mum's into the folk. So the Beatles sort of, they were just there in the background, but they were a bit too easy. So I always felt, I never really dipped into them till years later.
Right, there is no prog without Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
There is no Pink Floyd without...
They opened
Tomorrow
the door.
Never Knows. Yeah, absolutely. They opened all of these kind of doors using acid to do it.
Yeah.
I, as a 9-year-old boy, I was allowed to stay up Boxing Day in 1967 to watch the Magical Mystery Tour, the whole of which is an acid trip. It's made on acid. Not supposed to be an acid trip. It's an actual acid trip. Owsley acid. The world's finest acid imported in film canisters from America. Bob, of course, was the first person to have any Owsley acid in this country. And it was that he gave to R.D. Lang.
Who else would it be?
Who else would it be?
Who else could it
be? No, that's right. Bob was the first person to import Afghan coats, which was the sort of the default costume of the hippie. Procol Harum were named after Bob's cat, which is like one of my favourites.
You can't make it up.
No, you can't. One of my favourites is that Bob and his friend Duncan Laurie were the first people to light the Pink Floyd using an oil wheel projector. So that whole thing, pictures that you see of the Floyd with the oil wheel behind, is Bob and Duncan Laurie were the first people to do that. Church Hall in Notting Hill.
So you could say that it's kind of long overdue, this kind of some sort of recognition of the role.
The role of Bob, but the role of the counterculture.
Yeah.
This is a really important culture.
Kind of thing, as you see. Yeah.
I mean, you know, so there's your parents listening to, say, the Canterbury scene, you know. I mean, Soft Machine were the first band I saw.
Really?
Yeah, and Soft Machine were at the launch of IT at the Roundhouse They were one of the bands who played at that, where they drove a motorbike into the roundhouse, where famously there was a bath full of jelly laced with acid in the middle of the roundhouse. And it went completely mental. That's your dad's music.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? My dad, on a good day, he listened to Frank Sinatra, but mostly he listened to Daniel O'Donnell.
Wow.
Real shit my dad listened to.
Yeah.
I mean, terrible, terrible things. So this world, so it's your dad. Just imagine. I'm 60 in a few weeks' time. So
happy birthday.
God bless you. So my parents come from a world before all of this.
Yeah.
But your parents don't.
Yeah.
You know, your parents were listening to...
That's how generations evolve, right? Like, you know, I mean, but this particular thing, I was listening to a podcast recently with one of the guys who was making the Owsley Acid.
Oh, right, yeah, okay.
Who's featured in that Sunshine Makers film.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was saying, there's this whole rant at the start about so many people saying that the 60s counterculture was, the 60s were a failure and, you know, counterculture didn't work and all these kind of experiments of it were just, and he was just like going on a rant saying it was nonsense. So look at the knock-on effects that we still are around us everywhere today in popular culture. And that's on the American side, of course, but what you're talking about is... Here in the UK, I'm just really fascinated to find it. Feels like a heritage that I didn't know, that I sort of knew existed, but didn't know all the depths of. You know, like it's just like the pieces of the puzzle.
But it's so weird that it's become heritage, and weird. And one of the things I write about is the moment where I realised that it was heritage and no longer active culture, and two things really, and it was when I was teaching at Birmingham City University, Birmingham's third most prestigious university. don't start me. Alas, one of my students had a Ramones T-shirt on. I said, "I saw the Ramones." She said, "Oh, were they a band?"
Yeah.
But we knew this was true, but it was, that was the moment that I went, oh. And the next one was at a festival, and I did walk about theatre at festivals, and I played clergyman for many years. Comedy pervy clergyman is my specialisation. And so I saw this bloke in his early 20s walking along with a T-shirt covered in the CND symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, marvellous, CND. Yes, indeed. Burn the bomb. When I was a young curate, I went on the march. Oh. And he said, you are? I said, you know, CND, marvellous, burn the bomb. He went, what are you on about? I'm saying, you know, well, I'm increasingly dropping out of character.
Oh,
I'm
goodness.
Saying, you know, that... the CND, you know, you've got the symbol of CND on all over your T-shirt. Mm. You're going, oh, is that what it was? I thought it was just a cool symbol. But it can't be a symbol, my friend. It's a shape, you know. It has lost all of its symbolic significance. You don't even know what it is.
Wow, that's such a... yeah, that's such a sign of the commodification of the times, the present. How do we... Although that said, there's a lot of positivity and change in the air as well in some circles that I've kind of noticed, especially in the psychedelic culture. It's sort of a resurgence in interest in research. You know, that kind of stuff seems to be very healthy as the sort of walls come down around legitimate research around all this stuff.
I think so. Okay, again, as a kid, I grew up, the Beatles were the biggest entertainment brand in the world. They were quite Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. It's not about LSD. Bollocks, of course. You know, don't
it's so overt, though. Yeah. It's just there, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't need to interpret it too heavily.
No, you don't. we grew up reading the NME.
Mm.
The New Musical Express.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Okay. the New Musical Express sold 250,000 copies a week in the 70s.
Yeah, wow.
And you would have... so that I remember one of the things I looked at for the making of the book was the 31st of January 1976, which has the first review of the Sex Pistols called Don't Look Now, The Sex Pistols Coming, by a bloke called Neil Spencer. It had Patti Smith on the cover talking about... an interview with Patti Smith talking about Verlaine. It's 250,000 copies. At the forefront of popular culture, I'm not sure what kind of popular culture... because I don't understand the internet in the same way that you do, I don't know what thing young people are seeing every single week that says, here's your favourite, coolest rock and roll star in the world talking about French symbolist poets. I can't think of one.
No, it's
and then
much
inside,
lead.
There's a big article, and I was 17, but I'd been reading it for years and things like it. There's a thing in it about two reggae stars called Iroy and Uroy. And it's about how do you tell the difference between Iroy and Uroy? And they had a picture of Iroy and they had a picture of Uroy. But both of them are smoking fucking great big chillums. So both of them are completely covered in smoke. So in the stuff that we were reading was by Charlie Murray, was by Mick Farren, was by these countercultural people who were contemporary with Bob, urging us, as young people, what we needed to do was take drugs and fuck. That was our job, that we would change the world by taking drugs and fucking. You know, that clearly hasn't quite come off. But this was a very mainstream, if you like, the counterculture, you know, was at the front of the news. As I say, this is the Beatles culture, the biggest entertainment brand in the world, put in contemporary terms. This was not some obscure culture that people, you know, encountered in a peripheral way. There was an advert for soap powder a few years ago, where a kid came home from a festival with his clothes covered in mud and his mum chucked it in the washing machine saying, of course, in my day, we didn't wear clothes. And he sort of goes, but it's true.
Do you think these things go in cycles?
Don't know.
Do you think there'll be a return to the... I mean, it's just something that I ponder, you know, like that time... was very of its time, and obviously things are always changing.
Yeah.
But the continued influence of such a strong, I don't know how to describe it in words, really. It's such an influential period in time across the world. Will we ever see a period of time that has that influence again? You know, it's like everything's so locked down now. Everything
is
so controlled, so... It's almost like some people saw that time and went, oh, we're never having that ever again.
I think so. I mean, it began quite early on, the repression, if you like. So as those ideas came to floration, may word of the day.
Good word.
There was a concomitant repression that went alongside it.
Okay.
You know, that went alongside it pretty quickly. So there were raids on bookshops. People were being done for obscenity. IT was closed down because... right, so I'm not gay. And I can just remember... a world where being gay was not a wise thing to be. How did you meet friends if you were gay? It was really difficult. It's not like now. There isn't sort of Tinder. You can't go in the pub and say, actually, I'm gay. Anyone else here gay? Yes, we're all gay. You know, there wouldn't be any problem. So there's a sense in which things aren't locked down. Mm. People advertised in IT. Mm. IT was busted for that. Oz, the Oz School Kids edition, which is kind of pre... We would find it very difficult to look at now,
okay.
In fact.
Okay.
Was closed down for having gay adverts and sex adverts in it. Mm. There was a hippie terrorist organisation called the Angry Brigade,
yeah.
Which is a bit rubbish.
It sounds a bit
kind
rubbish.
Of, luckily, because they didn't actually kill anybody, kind of, by luck. But they were hippies.
How does that work? The hippies who are
angry. Oh, because it wasn't peace and love.
No.
Oh, no, that's an American idea. That's just a sort of little fashion blip of sort of the summer of 67.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
But authenticity, expressing your authentic self in a playful, a ludic existence, that we're going to be playful people. That we're going to play our way, you know, whatever the sort of consequences. Inevitably, there was stuff about it that was difficult as well. You know, it's not just a story of sunlight. But it became close and close and close. So my book finishes in 1994 because of the passing of the Criminal Justice Act of 1994, which came about in reaction to the Castle Morton Free Festival of 1992.
Okay.
It's about 250,000 people at Castle Morton, which is only about 30 miles away from here. It was the lead item on the BBC News, two nights running. So on the Friday night, the BBC, 6 o'clock, there's a huge free festival with people taking drugs at Castle Morton. I mean, they might as well give the nearest train station. Yeah, it would be Malvern. Yeah. Change it.
How many people saw that and were like, yep.
So the next night, it was massive. It was massive. Mm. And they once again, it led the news on the Saturday night. So that by the Sunday, it was huge. Lots of people who were turning up didn't know how to live outdoors. Bob knows how to live outdoors. He knows where to shit. It's very important. There was sort of, so you have things like the Spiral Tribe turning up at Castle Morton, massive sound systems, people shitting on the ground.
So it got pretty crazy.
It got really crazy, and the government said, you know, we're going to stop. The John Major government, he says, you know, new age travellers, you know, not in this age, not... or in any age. So it became increasingly repressed. But does that account for the fact that we live in extraordinarily, it seems to me, conservative times, lockdown, deeply conservative times?
Do you think there's scope for doing a follow-up to this, as in the after effect of the last kind of 25 years?
I hope somebody does. It won't be me.
No.
Because, you know, I've started work on a new idea.
Should we I think leave
best.
That for another one.
I think
yeah.
You won't want to talk to me about that.
Oh really?
Yeah, we live in deeply conservative times, and without wishing to, you know, who won the referendum?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got some Lexit, I'm just about to call them friends, I've got some left extra ex-friends, you know, who thought, oh, well, we'll be able to blah, 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 blah. And were happy to go through the lobbies with Britain First. Happy to vote. Not everyone who voted Leave is a racist.
Yeah.
All racists voted Leave.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people were happy to vote with them. For what? For Churchill.
Yeah.
Marvellous.
Yeah.
For Dunkirk, marvellous. A fucking awful fictionalisation of British history, which this book is hopefully some sort of counterblast against, to say there are other histories of the world and other histories of Britain and not just Churchill, marvellous, standing alone. Fucking stood alone. He almost starved to death, you tosspot. Those are the people who run this country. They do. In America, yeah.
Well,
what?
Worms can. Yeah.
They run the country. The best people in the world, it seems to me, are people from Eritrea and sub-Saharan Africa. From a capitalist point of view, from a, you know, let's get on, and, you know, from people like ourselves who thought, let's move somewhere and make a new future to ourselves. You're living in South Sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. You're being bombed to fucking death. You cross the Sahara Desert. Somehow. You get to the coast of Libya. For fuck's sake, for Libya. You get across the Mediterranean, this is the 3rd of February,
yeah,
and over 300 people have been killed crossing the Mediterranean this year. You know, in the last 30 days.
Mm.
They get to Europe, they face all this shit, they somehow manage to hack across Europe with nothing, they get to Calais, they survive in Calais, and somehow they manage to climb onto the back of a wagon and get to Dover. They should be given the keys. It's a fucking management, you know, brilliant. Yeah. How have you done that?
Yeah.
That is amazing. Please welcome to our country. You wanted to come here that much.
Yeah.
Come in, man.
It's such a statement, isn't it?
Like, it is.
Makes the Olympics look like a load of bollocks.
We live in this world that it seems to me is dedicated to hate, is dedicated to keeping people out, to shutting down, to locking down. No, fuck them. Fuck them. I'll always stand against them. Always, always, always. And I think a lot of people who came out of the counterculture want that, you know, want to stand up and say no. And I think one of the things that worries us, and I sound like I'm speaking for my dying generation, but one of the things that worries me, so for example, the Labour Party say, well, we need to invest in infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the infrastructure is, you know, we need to invest, by investing in infrastructure, these are good things. We tied ourselves to trees to stop infrastructure.
Mm.
You know, we have to stop. We have to stop growing. We have to stop and think about what's happening to the world.
But this is the kind of, as long as you're in the, yeah, no, yeah. It's, but you feel free. This is the thing that's, as long as we live in a capitalistic system, then growth is the ultimate end goal, right?
Like, yeah,
you have to kind of step outside of capitalism, and I don't see how you can do that, maybe on a small scale, but in a governmental level, it takes something massive or somebody extremely brave to try and rework that as a system. Like, it's going to, I think the most change that's going to happen is going to come from local level and grassroots level, and things like, you know, self-organized local council stuff. Like, the power isn't going to just come trickling down. I don't know. I get most enthused by things where it's like real people getting involved in local politics. You know, I think that's the most exciting thing for me at the moment.
It seems like
the main government just seems like this kind of fairies, you know, it's just a story of all these crazy characters. It's hard to identify with that.
It's very hard to identify.
Mm.
And there are, the Welsh government had a little bit of money for improving cycle paths. My wife was a town councillor and heard about this money and took my stepdaughter out on their bikes and rode around Prestine and looked at where the traffic was bad and where they would need to have crossing points. And then the town council managed to get a bit of money, and that's why this big new cycle path is being built, because of a little bit of, you know, a smaller unit of government, i.e. the Welsh Assembly.
Yeah.
And then local people seeing that they meant it, and so hopefully it'll be a better place to ride your bike around in. As a consequence of sort of local
things.
That's
great. That's direct kind of an impact. Yeah,
so there are examples of that.
Mm.
And yet we're still in thrall to the big... You see, the hippies thought of them as... They smoked tobacco and drank whiskey. You know, the hippies thought of them in terms of the drugs that they took, whereas the hippies smoked spliff and took acid. And that whole, what was called the military-industrial complex by the President of the United States of America, who recognised that it was a danger. Eisenhower recognised that this was a danger. You know, the taking apart of that, hopefully, you're right, comes from people. But to do that, I would wish to argue, you have to change people's consciousness.
Yeah, 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 very much so. That's something why I think I would massively welcome, you know, the drug reform law. The drug laws are horrendously outdated, horrendously wrong, you know, like... There's so much good that can come from some of these substances used in the right way, maybe in the wrong way sometimes. But
if you look at acid, I mean, take Professor Nutt's.
Yeah,
I love Professor Nutt. He's imagine great, being called Professor Nutt.
Have you seen what he's up to recently?
No, what's Professor Nutt up to?
He's trying to develop a synthetic alcohol substitute that doesn't give you a hangover.
God bless him.
We'll see.
In his list of harms, where LSD is at number 19 or something and ecstasy is at number 16, we know the pharmacology of those things inside out, absolutely inside out. E is over 100 years old. It probably wasn't tested on humans until the 70s, except it's in the book.
Ah, excellent.
But we know the pharmacology of it, and we know the pharmacology of acid inside out. With Timothy Leary and the Beatles, because the Beatles ingested Timothy Leary as much as they did acid.
Okay.
He wrote How to Take Acid book. There was a culture of how to take acid. It wasn't a party drug. It was a take a pill and sit on top of a hill drug. We know the pharmacology of these things inside out. Of course, you should be able to nip up the chemist and say, "Hello, Mrs. Smith, I'd like one tablet of LSD and two of ecstasy, please." Yeah. And because it's a chemist, they'd say, "Well, actually, Johnny, I think you had. Didn't I sell you an LSD yesterday, Johnny? Have you had that already?" And of course, it should be available in the chemist. Heroin, I remember very well the moment where heroin became fully illegal in this country. And up until then, I didn't know anyone who took heroin. All the time heroin was legal, of course people did, and Bob knew people in London. And he claims that one of the reasons that the hippies started to come out of London was that heroin was beginning to become a bit of a cultural problem. But I didn't know anyone who took heroin. It's the moment at which heroin became illegal that I arrived in New Haven. It's the moment at which heroin became illegal that I started to lose friends that I'd been to school to it. That's when they started dying. And as for spliff, it's called weed because it's a weed. You know, it grows everywhere. We know its harms. There is evidence that people who smoke it under 18, who have had some history in their family of psychosis, probably should delay smoking it until they're in their early 20s. And maybe occasionally even think about it. I mean, I've known people with cannabis psychosis, and it isn't pretty.
But then part of that is due to the lack of control over what these substances are, what they contain, the strains that have been, you know, bred for the most ridiculous THC levels possible without, you know, balancing.
And I've smoked cannabis with thousands of people, and I've known maybe five people with cannabis psychosis. And in all of their cases, you know, I know that they were doing it probably too young. So once again, instead of thinking this is a largely benign substance which people have smoked for thousands of years, you know, you don't take drugs in order to sit in a corner of a room covered in your own piss, shivering and looking like something in a government warning film. People take drugs because it's nice. and because they have a good time. And when we say, oh, you mustn't take drugs or you'll die, people look around them and go, well, they don't, do they?
Yeah.
So, of course, so weed, there are loads of ways you could do it. Uruguay model.
Mm-hmm.
Sold well, through government shops.
Canada.
Canada's doing a similar thing.
Yeah, several countries.
Geneva, you can just grow it.
You can grow a few plants. Yeah, I mean, it seems like these kind of sensible reforms are happening. And, you know, all it takes is a few places to do this kind of stuff. And then other places go, oh, look at the revenue of Colorado's in the billions of dollars. You know, then it starts and businesses start going, ah, actually, we could make some money here. And then there's pressure on the government. These things can change, but like, yeah.
Absolutely. So that's consciousness changing.
Yeah.
But there are also mainstream ways in which consciousness... so, again, I started secondary school in 1969 in a secondary school that had only been opened the year before, i.e. 1968, with lots of young teachers who graduated in 1968. 1968 is the great year of student revolt, of art school strikes and... on the poverty of the student life, Situationist tracts, read by tens of thousands of people. They were my teachers. So we were taught by Soixante-Huitard, by people who'd come out of 68, by Marxists, by people who wanted to change the world, by people who thought the job of education was to change the world. Of course, the government couldn't have that. Can't have that. The first speech ever by a British Prime Minister on education was James Callaghan in 1976. Up until that point, it had been completely left to teachers. By the middle of the 70s, it was clear that the teachers were saying, yo, kids, let's change the world again. You know, you can't have that. And so you see the emphasis on reading, writing, arithmetic. You see the kind of Govian emphasis on British history, which once again is, you know, kings, queens, battles, Churchill, Dunkirk, marvellous.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I feel like I've got all these gaps, you know. I mean, there was just, it was so limited. World War II, that's it, you know, a bit of the Normans. Just felt so limiting. And then you start, as you grow up and you start hearing about all these other things, you're like, what? You're joking. We didn't. The British Empire, you know, there's so many, unfortunately, hidden stories about all the stuff that's happened. It's like...
Yeah. If I feel like you're the son I never had. And if you had been, my daughters would say to you, don't say the Normans.
Oh, really?
So this... So I think we're going to have to come to... Because when you say the Normans, who runs this country, man?
Yeah.
Not the Saxons.
That's true.
Fuck them. Who owns this country? Not us. Who? That's the thing, you see. The people who own this country are not interested in you and me at all. They don't give a fuck in what we think or do. The Normans. Don't talk about the Normans. It's their country, not ours. Cameron is direct descendant of kind of Norman aristocracy.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. He's the Queen's fifth cousin or something. Ugh. It's the same people. It's the Normans. Look at their names. Rhys Mogg. Do you know what I call Rhys Mogg?
No.
Cunt. That's my witty nickname for him.
Fitting.
Yeah. They own it. It's not our country. We owe them nothing. Nothing. Marvellous. Churchill. Fuck, Churchill's a Norman. You can tell. He's looking out of the window now.
There's somebody approaching.
The Normans, says one.
They're coming.
She's coming to put money through the door.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Do you need to engage with them?
No. Okay. She's my hoe.
Okay.
They have to come and give me part of their takings.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Ian, give me the deets on the book.
The deets? What book? You mean A Hero for High Times?
I mean, a Younger Reader's Guide
to the Beats, Hippies, Heads, Freaks, Punks, Ravers, New Age Fellow Travellers, and Dog on a Rope Brew Crew Crusties of the British Isles, 1956-1994. Published by Jonathan Cape.
Jonathan Cape.
Available from the middle of February. What can I tell you? In all good bookshops. It's a cover by Johnny Hanna. Always judge a book by its cover.
Nice.
And it's the history of the counterculture told through the story of one old counterculturista.
Hmm. It sounds to
buy
me
it,
like...
But don't forget that if you take it out of the library, that's good. If you order it from a library, I get 12p.
If you take it out of the library...
I get 12p.
Huh.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And if you nick it, it counts as a sale. As long as you nick it from a bookshop.
Okay, old school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I hope people do go out and read this, because it seems to me
not read it, buy it.
Buy it, read it, steal
it. Yeah, buy
it
then. Yeah, buy, read. All right.
Give it away.
All right, read it then.
Yeah, please read it. No, I will definitely be buying and reading it, and then probably talking to you again about it, because I'm sure I will have learnt a whole lot.
You're always welcome.
Ian, thank you so much for your time today.
Huge pleasure. Thank you for yours.
Do you have a website you want to link to?
www.ianmarchant.com.
And all your, what's on there, what's on your website, writings?
Bits and bats of blogs, links to all of my books, links to the radio programmes. And, yeah.
Brilliant.
Things to see and do.
Thanks, man. Thank you. That's
huge
been great.
Pleasure. Mm. Huge pleasure.
We found our way. La la la.